and have taught about before, as well as something that's pretty pertinent to talk about in this setting, period. So because of the second of those two, I've actually asked a few people who are on the staff here to join us in the second session, which is not till Wednesday, to talk about right livelihood from the point of view of having chosen to volunteer here and why. And now having done it, you know, how does that contrast or compare with what, if they can remember life outside of this place, what their work was there and what it gave them. So today I'd just really like to share some ideas that I have that bring me to this, and really more about my own work experience that brings me to this interest, and then get back from you. I also have readings, and if this group stays this cozy, nobody will have to share, but I think sharing is not a problem in this place as well. But I'm not going to pass them out now. I'm just let you know where I'm coming from. There was a fellow I taught with for years on the Urban Studies program named Lou Palmer, who was a wonderful leadership figure in the Black community in Chicago for many years, and also was a key figure in getting Harold Washington, who the then first congressional district representative, to run for mayor, and helped put together the coalition that got him winning the second time he did it. Lou Palmer used to say to his students, first I'm going to tell you where I'm coming from, because that affects everything from how you are able to share where you're coming from, as well as how you're able to place my remarks in some context whatsoever. I am a city person. Despite my ease and comfort and hiking in these hills, I am a city person. And that means I get a little itchy when I'm surrounded by a lot of white people. I come from Chicago. It is a very multicultural place, and multiracial as well. So I've had the wonderful experience, come on in, welcome, of having two different works, as job works, that I've loved. And a couple of other involvements that I love equally that I've also not been paid for. There are times when one of my works didn't pay me as well. So let me just kick off with that. Right livelihood came to me as a concept really almost when this book was written, a little before this book, but in a little book put together by the Briar Patch, which is a West Coast phenomenon. Michael Phillips and some other people in San Francisco put together the Briar Patch Network to support what they called conscious businesses that were coming into being, whether it was around food, clothing, putting together educational curriculum materials, more traditional businesses, real estate, clothing, manufacturers, etc., who came together with a slightly alternative, although I really hate to rest on that term, notion of business, one that would be somewhat less inclined to hierarchical setups of the business world that they were surrounded by at the time, the times being late 60s, early 70s. Well, my partner and I read this book called The Seven Laws of Money by Michael Phillips, who is part of the Briar Patch Network. And in that, the notion of right livelihood, which is really a total steal from the Buddhist Eightfold Path, one of the right ways to be. And it's, if you want the others, I'll tell you later. ways to enlightenment, basically, eightfold path. And right livelihood referred to occupying yourself rightly, consciously. And I put up there his their specific definition is, and it refers to an occupation that causes no harm to any living being, any sentient being. As Buddhists refer to, that's everything. So clearly we did not observe the strict letter of the law in terms of right livelihood, because if we did, we'd look closer to something like Holden or even more radical. And there's just, we've moved away from Buddhist notion of right livelihood in the most strict sense. But for our way of thinking, it was a good way to approach what we already were working on, which was starting a restaurant in that opened in 1976, which had for its motivation three purposes. In 1976, Chicago did not have any places where you could get brown rice. Unless for a couple of very strange places that if you went into them, one, they smelled bad. And two, whoever was behind the counter was rather drawn, gray, and forbidding. And both my partner and I had a long history of hanging out at Greasy Spoons and eating, you know, what is not good for you. But enjoying the camaraderie that happens around a countertop with working people and the newspaper and the coffee and the greasy eggs and bacon and everything else. Okay, we wanted everything there but the grease, okay? So we wanted to do a wholesome foods Greasy Spoon. Good wholesome food for the mind and body for a reasonable price. That was the other thing. If you wanted to eat really healthy at that time, you had to really have a lot of money because there was... So there was that was one of our motives. The second was to provide a more... positive than generally encountered work experience in that industry. The restaurant industry in 1976 was a lot different than it is today. And one of the things that we did that now everyone does, I guess, is we asked for people to come to us who had ideas on how we could do our business. I was 26 at the time, and so I hired a bunch of people I knew, first of all, which was one of the many business rules we broke right off the bat. You're not supposed to hire friends, family, roommates, lovers, God help us. We did all of that. I digress so freely. I'm just going to drag myself back. So the second one was a good work experience for the workers. The third purpose, our reason for being, was to provide a community center, if you will, that would provide whoever walked in and people who heard of the place information on issues and questions that we thought were important. We were political people, basically. We started the restaurant because you don't make money doing politics, certainly not in 1976, and not the kind of politics we did. There's lots of people who make money doing politics, but I'll talk about that sometime later this week. So we wanted to provide a community center, a place where we could basically stage our version, our propaganda, if you will. And we do that through writing a newspaper that has come out on and off regularly for 20 years now. Not all 24 years did we have that, but we do. We also we take part in a lot of different events that are either coalition type events in the community or wider belongings. We belong to the Athletes United for Peace, which is an outfit that springs out of Portland area, Washington State area, from former athletes, Olympic athletes and professional athletes who decided that the way that they encountered athletes from countries that were forbidden in the old terms, Cold War terms, was a good way to cross the big chasm between our countries. And so Athletes United for Peace is an outfit that sends you know, just regular folks like us to Cuba and play baseball with regular folks in Cuba and all kind of other pretty low-tech peace initiatives in that way. Okay, so those were our three reasons and purposes for starting the Heartland Cafe. You will note none of them was to make money. This was a mistake. I'm telling you that now. Because the three purposes that we stated and our motivations and intentions were good, were pure, and happened like that. But money, it was not there. But luckily for us, there is magic in the universe, or spirit, or grace, however you'd like to refer to it, and that really carried us a long way. So that we are still open 24 years later. but I would recommend, if I were giving a class in starting your own business, make money be there somewhere, not at the top of the list. Doesn't have to be there, top, bottom. Oh, and by the way, to have a positive bottom line, that would be a good thing to put. Okay, so our notion was to do good by, to do well doing good. We wanted to do good by doing good. We wanted to employ people, and in order for them to support the other work in their lives, whether it was student work, artwork, developing their arts, which, you know, anybody who's an artist knows that for a long, long time, you know, you are a waiter or waitress, cook, whatever you can be, while you are waiting for the world to catch up with you. And so we have had a lot of that. But we also wanted to support the community life around us. In the community of Rogers Park in Chicago, it is in Chicago proper. I don't say I'm from Chicago and mean Schaumburg or Naperville or Lake Forest, God help us. So you always have to sort of pin someone down that way. And they say, I'm from New York. Well, New York is a different story. But Chicago is, we were located, and the reason we located in there, this community, was one, it was a space that we could afford, and the reason we could afford it was that it was a quote-unquote changing neighborhood. Now, this is a neighborhood I went to college in, and it has never stopped changing. It is not changing in the way the South Side neighborhood where I grew up was changing, which was white to black. White to black, one after another, like dominoes, thanks to racism, the pernicious activity of real estate people, and the turning their back on it by the leaders of the city, namely Richard M. J. Daley at that time. But that's a different kind of changing neighborhood. Our neighborhood is changing as I speak. We have the newest immigrants in large numbers in our neighborhood and one other uptown, that is the Bosnians. We have about 8,000 Bosnians in my neighborhood. In Chicago, a neighborhood is often confused with a ward, which it can be. There are 50 wards in Chicago. Those are the political units, and there are 55,000 people in each of those political units. So a neighborhood in Chicago is, you know, equal to a lot of towns that some folks here come from, or, you know, half of a town. So you can really get very involved in just living in your neighborhood. It becomes your village, your Holden, as it were. And you also, as you look at notions about right livelihood and the economy of scale, you hope for a neighborhood that sort of allows you not only to work in it, but to study in it, to play in it, and to do all of that on a bike or on foot is a really special thing. And Rogers Park is one of those kinds of places. And the other fact of the matter is that we're right on the elevated train, what is now called the Red Line. It used to be called the Howard, but we advance, we grow, and even adults get to learn how to say different words for the trains they grew up with. So it is now the Red Line. And the Red Line to the Heartland is something that my erstwhile communist partner likes to say. Take the Red Line to the Heartland. okay, the other great work that I've been fortunate enough to do was to teach college students, and I actually started doing this about 6 months before I even met my business partner. So I kept doing it mostly because my parents would have an easier time of it telling their friends that I was a college teacher than that I was a restaurateur, given that I didn't know diddly about cooking or business or anything. So I kept the teaching gig, and the teaching gig was with Urban Studies Program, which was a off-campus experientially based education semester, drawing students from about 15 associated colleges in the Midwest, many of which there are folks here from. In fact, Cynthia, who's teaching a class now, was on the Urban Studies program 26 years ago, and another guy who works here, I forget, Glenn, no, I'll come up, was also on the program a year before I started teaching. Anyway, the special thing about, there are many special things about this program, but what I so enjoyed was that as a Chicago citizen who had been, you know, in no small degree, very involved politically, right up from age 16 or 17 on, first based on that whole racial change thing that I briefly described, but then also in a political way, in trying to get past the regular Democratic machine and get someone of independent thinking in the city council, which, you know, had been pretty impossible. As knowing all that, having stayed in Chicago for college and everything, I learned so much as soon as I started with this program, because what we would basically do is bring these students from one end of town to the other on public transportation, introduce them to leaders of various communities. I met with the heads of the Korean community, the Polish community, and of course Latin, Black, youth, gay, and have basically the actors who were involved in the issues talk to our students. In so doing, I got educated. And my idea of education was supported by that as well, because the students had to also put in some 20 hours a week at an internship. Now, if they call these things internships, then we called it their work assignment. But in the course of teaching that teaching on that program, and over the years, my assignment changed until the last 12 years I was full-time, and I was teaching the politics and government seminar. Due to the fact that I had access to dozens of people in office, people trying to get in office, people who helped folks get in office, and could bring students to their places, such as David Axelrod, the famous spin doctor for numerous presidents and numerous other candidates around the country, but in Chicago he worked for Daley and I think our present governor even, and have him talk to them directly and give them a little run through on what they do and how it fits with the whole scheme of things. I thought it was just a great holistic education. I thought it was a great educational stunt that they were pulling, bringing these kids into the city, thereby debunking all of the scary, you know, heebie-jeebies they were fed by news media or by, you know, elderly uncles or aunts who'd never been to the city. And, you know, so I would start by saying, who told, you know, when you first told your family you were coming to Chicago for a semester, you know, how many of them said, oh, you're going to die, you're going to get... And I go, okay, and for those who did have people like that, when was the last time they were in Chicago? Oh, never. Okay, well then let's just set that aside and start getting to know Chicago on our own. And in fact, many of these young people went on to do wonderful things. And in fact, a former student of mine is my alderman in city council. Which is going to be tricky because now he's turning into a guy we're going to have to work against. But stuff happens, you know. Okay, so all of that is to say that I really am, I'm a working stiff. In Chicago terms, I am a working stiff. I like to work. I need to work. And I have been fortunate. I've had the great good fortune to have work I've loved, which means I am not any longer drawn to work I wouldn't love. I'm not even the slightest bit inclined to trip into that. I don't have radar for that anymore. And I'm actually at a point where I'm going to start looking to find the next great thing. So we can have that conversation together is what I'm hoping here. The Holden element, I just have to share that when I arrived here, I came a few days early because I really did need R&R. The restaurant business, even 24 years later, if you have no other excuse to do something else, will keep you occupied 8 to 12 hours a day. And I'm too old for that. You know, we have 50 employees. They're young. They can do that. And they get paid, and I'll find some money somewhere else. sitting down. No, I like to run around. The Holden element for me was, it was interesting. I arrived early. I got housed in a chalet, which I have no idea of the cachet, you know, of things when I first arrived here. So, and plus I'm teaching staff, but I'm not quite teaching staff yet, and I'm living in a chalet. And there's also this sort of animal house feel to the chalet. Okay, it's clearly been the party center for at least most recently, right before my arrival. And there's a little unspoken tension in the air. So, I don't know why. I woke up the first morning at 6 o'clock, and I completely cleaned the whole common living room, kitchen, wash all the dishes, etc. And I know that I was just trying to be helpful, you know. But I was also, it was my grandmother, my immigrant Irish grandmother in me doing this, saying, this is what you do. You do this. You come in, you sweep up, you put the pillows back up, you wash it off. I was also, I think, trying to make peace with these unspoken, you know, tensions that I felt. And then a couple days later, when I realized that there was another smoking member, please don't hate me for that, in that house, who had developed his own peace with whatever the powers that be, that he has a can and he smokes on the back porch. Back porch was yet another undiscovered realm by anything like a broom in a long, long time. So the third day I was here, after I'd taken a nice hike, I went home and I cleaned the back porch off, which, it, you know, made good connection with the other fellow in the house who smokes, and another kid who had been sort of passing through, of course, didn't even notice it, and it told me so much. So the working thing, it's about also connecting, and right livelihood ultimately is about a wholeness in your life, not that separation that so many people suffer, that they are putting in hour after hour of their precious life on this earth for someone else's purposes, and sometimes even at odd purposes to their own, ethically, politically, personally, and putting off what is most meaningful to them, whether it's their family life, their spiritual, their political involvement, their community activism, to the time left over. So when I started teaching the internship seminar at Urban Studies that I called Chop Wood, Carry Water, it was in the context of college students who were in the city, who were very, very on fire with this immense semester in their life, and they were reflecting on their work experiences in their internships, which are, of course, not real work experiences, as we would say it as adults, but in fact, they really, really informed these students afterwards, their decisions that they made from there forward. they actually did get a glimpse at what it looks like to work in outfits that are actually trying to make change. And there were a vast array of different versions of the internship. Some of them worked in City Hall, had to dress the part every day. Some of them worked in pretty powerful not-for-profit organizations that did major grant applications to keep themselves alive. And then some of them worked in church basement after-school programs and everything in between. So for them to, say, read some articles about that I would give them, that some of which I'll give you, on work and its connection with making social change, as well as feeding your spiritual needs, it was good grist for the mill. In this setting, I think there are many things that you all have already put together in your lives, no doubt to a much greater degree than myself. So I need to open up to you in this first session and get your initial reactions to some of what I wrote up here, some of what I've just said. I'm sorry, so that you can see that. And I should say something about some of what I've read too, written. To get what you, what brought you to this session, I guess, simply. Why would you, besides the fact that, you know, I made you come, or I you know, bent your elbow or whatever, what was it that resonates for you when someone talks about the spiritual uses of everyday tasks? Because I do believe there's a lot of wisdom sitting in this room about that, just given that the fact that we're at Holden Village. You all know things. So I'll just, once again, right livelihood is the term, but we're really going far afield from the original strictest Buddhist sense, which was that as part of the Eightfold Path to Enlightenment, right livelihood refers to an occupation that causes a minimum of harm and suffering to other beings, whether human, plant, or animal. In this book, Chop Wood, Carry Water, which actually, this is my copy, but there is a copy in the library here, which I guess I should put on reserve. But I am going to pass out a chapter of it tonight and another one on another session. Michael Phillips is quoted in here, and again, he's the fellow from Briar Patch who wrote The Seven Laws of Money, wrote that right livelihood indicates a kind of working that should be an area of great passion, one, something you can spend your life doing, three, something that serves the community, and four, be completely appropriate to you. In a way, we can explore, I can go into what more he says about those in here, but I would like to ask you what your idea of this notion is and how you experience it, or what impedes you from experiencing that kind of wholeness, satisfaction, or however you would call it, the sort of seamless notion of one's life where you don't have to compartmentalize and hang your heart on a hook as you go out to work, only to dust it off and try and put it back when you come in. And if you think it's impossible, I would love to. I'd love to get down. And so let me just open it up to that right now.
It makes me think about a swimming area for a kid, and then anecdotally to me that, you know, you got the barriers out there. So to fulfill that four criteria means I got to go past barriers. And I'm not so comfortable doing that. Because like an area of great passion, it's like, well, yeah, but I got to be practical. I got to make the dough and spend my life doing, well, I think you get drummed in the message. It's a popular message of retirement. So you just meet your economic needs, parenting, college, and then you retire. It's not a lifelong thing. And that other aspect of it, the minimum of harm or suffering to others, there are occupations that involve harming and suffering.
Yes.
I guess at times I have said to myself, because I've had two occupations that involve that, I've said, well, I can do this, see? And I didn't want to get into that question, because who's going to do it? Well, I can do it. So for me, when I look at that, I say, oh, the great big ocean or the great big lake is there for me to swim, but I see these are the barriers for me. And I just throw that out to see what else people say.
And what, just let me ask you, what was your work?
I've been a prosecutor and I've been a soldier.
Uh-huh.
So they have a degree of harm.
Hard stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's hear from... I can read something from this about a little more on right livelihood. Should I do that? Let's see. This kind of teaching about the traditional, causing a minimum of harm and suffering to other beings. This kind of teaching made sense in the ancient world where there was a clear division of spiritual roles. The lay people worked hard to support themselves and their families, and the monks did their part by working on spiritual matters. Right livelihood is still a powerful teaching for today's world. However, it is all right to make one's living cutting down trees Is it all right to make one's living cutting down trees in an area where endangered species live? Or to burn tropical rainforests to make farmland? Or to manufacture pesticides that pollute rivers and streams? There are pressing political, ethical, and spiritual questions as fresh and timely as today's headlines. We might say that the practical consequences of a livelihood that harms, first pointed out by the Buddha more than two millennia ago, have now reached a critical point where they affect everyone. Just a little more, I'll read. In reality, we all participate in harm to other beings in one degree or another. If we read a newspaper, we're supporting the destruction of forests. If we use soap, river somewhere is polluted. There's no escape from this interdependence. And interdependence, I think, is the key to right livelihood. The fact that you cannot act without affecting the whole is the undergirding of the notion of right livelihood. So again, I'll just stop and see if someone has a reaction or question or gauntlet to throw down in any way. If you don't talk, I'm going to make you meditate.
Hey, I don't want to get off the track.
There's a track? Sorry.
Well, I thought he was very honest and it was helpful, and I have a different angle, so I don't know how helpful it is, but I'm wondering about how you think about this stuff that's on the board in connection with the people who work at the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are people who work at the restaurant for whom, even though you've tried to create good jobs, this is nevertheless not true for them, working at your place, and then I'm assuming there are others for whom they read this and say, yes, at least for this moment in my life, I've got it. But some people would say yes, and some would say no, in that same place. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Basically, this was a gauntlet throwing down. Yes. I think that's a great question to ask, because there are many jobs that you can't say the job itself, it's not my great passion. to walk around with a tray of 16, you know, things and set it down and, you know, then divvy it up. And God knows, I've spent more of my life doing that than I thought I would, but no, for the workers, they don't want to be doing that all their lives. They don't, it's not their great passion. But what I believe a lot of workers that we've had, and we've had these round tables regularly, once a year we have a staff confab that the people who run the place don't have anything to say about except they must attend. That is the managers and the owners. And the workers talk about what they want to talk about. What is their great passion is being able to be in a place that doesn't tell them to turn themselves inside out when they come in the door. What is their great passion is being part of a workforce that feels often like a team, and that does not have racial, gender, divisions as part of it. In many, many restaurants in the United States, Latinos perform very specific functions, and the line is not crossed between whites and Latin folks in restauranting. That has never been the case. In fact, it's been a very purposefully not the case in our restaurant, and that means that people stay there a long time. I have a Salvadoran dishwasher man who does not speak English. He most assuredly will not speak English. He's my age. He's been working there for 12 years. Now, dishwashing is a job. You have to have a ceiling on how much you can pay. And I had to explain this to him a few years back. Leonidas, no puedo pagarte más de $7 por dishwashing. That's the entry job, you know. The guys who start that and learn some English, then they go to busing and they make more. And then they go to... He goes, I know. What else can I do? And so he's got a full-time job doing a variety of maintenance chores and some dishes. And he's been there 12 years. And this is his support. And he also, despite the fact that everybody knows that he just refuses to speak English, he has relationships with everybody on the staff. Everyone knows him. Okay. They all feel it serves the community. They feel that by working at the Heartland, they are making a statement, because they could go and work at a Let Us Entertain You outfit and possibly make more, you know. But they are proud of the fact that they work at a place that is as wacko as the Heartland and does things like, in the middle of dinner hour, parades political, candidates in to shake hands with people and does all manner of weird things, like, you know, bioregional. Someone, it's on the board this week that the, something for all beings. We had that at the Heartland, whatever it is. I'm sorry, I can't remember. Yeah, Council of All Beings. So all of the bioregionalists in the Chicagoland area come walking in as frogs and suns and planets and whatever. And, you know, sometimes the staff is like, I hate it when you have these political events, they don't tip. You know, that's one of the big, you have issues like that. But at the same time, and you know, even when they'll say something like that, like, oh yeah, great, thanks, Katie, thanks for bringing us all these politicos or these other whatever, because they don't tip and they, you know, come up and expect service, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, they'll still go, you know, but that's why I'm here. You know, it doesn't happen 7 days a week. 6 days a week I make money, and then one day I come in and all hell's breaking loose. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. And then they laugh about it, and it becomes a tremendous, you know, piece of whatever, the literature of their lives, that they have this place that they share with this tribe of people, and they can make fun of it. And key is it appropriate to you? What I think that And just staying on your question, I think people use the Heartland as an incubator place. It's their transition spot. And I bet anything, when we hear from the Holden staff people in the next couple days, they'll say something similar, that this is a cradle place that holds them while they move from place to place in their life. And it's also a place they can come back to. God knows, we've rehired a few people from time to time. They've reappeared in new incarnations as something that you had to pay more because they were older and might have a baby to support now or something. But does that speak to that?
Yes, sir. A lot of it is through transitions of, I know when working with restaurants, there's a lot of turnover and there's a lot of transition with employees. Is there, and then another follow-up question was the different ethnicities that the place has, is does that cause any friction between that work?
One, turnover at the Heartland is off the charts, low for restaurant. I don't know if that's true anymore. We did a study, we took part in a study when we were 10 years old, and we did a sort of limped up at it version of it 5 years after that. We were still completely skewed in terms of our turnover rate, and it was people like Leonides that did that, and a number of cooks who've been there 10 years and that sort of thing. So we don't have as great a turnover as most restaurants, and I also think the restaurant industry changed in our direction in the last 24 years. I have observed this most assuredly. You know, there is always friction in American society when interracial, multicultural groups actually have to face each other and figure out how to deal with each other. My feeling is to have that, to have the interaction, give people the opportunity to figure out how the heck to do it. And so for the most part, what we have is a lot of mixed dating and marriages and whatnot happening. We have tremendous love happening between white kids from the suburbs, hip-hop kids from the city, black kids, whether they're from city or suburb, all manner of Mexican, Nicaraguan, Salvadoran, Guatemalan. We have a man from Africa right now. We have no Asian person on the staff at the moment. We have had Native Americans on the staff. So we actually strive to do that. I mean, we are an affirmative action outfit from the get-go. We look for applications when we're low on, you know, the array on the rainbow in front of us. Seek out from people in the community. Say, we need some young black guy in here soon, right now. And we try and rustle somebody up who needs the work and for whom the Heartland is a fit. It's not a fit for everybody, you know. Some people, the sort of scene, it does not suit them, but anyway, that answered that. Yeah. Yes.
It sort of strikes me that, you know, when you're talking about all the artists being at your restaurant, it's kind of the place I am at, like, in my life right now, that maybe right now I'm parenting two little children.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really working outside of the home. That's my thing right now, and I'll be looking to pick up some work in the next year or two. Mm-hmm. It may not be like the work of my passion.
Right.
Maybe supporting my primary vocation as parent.
Right.
And, you know, it strikes me that that's probably true of a lot of people working at the restaurant.
That's what I was trying to indicate. It's, you know, I never thought I was going to own a restaurant. at all. And what surprised the heck out of me in the first few years I had it was how many total strangers who were our customers would say to me, I've always wanted to have a restaurant. Hundreds of people are out there wanting to always have wanting to start a restaurant. I never did. I never wanted to start a restaurant. And and what completely floored me was the incredible satisfaction of nurturing people. People come to restaurants in this day and age in our culture to get something that they don't have available somewhere else. On one day or all the time. So you have the concept of regulars, whether they are single people, married people. We have lots of little kids. We are baby friendly to it. And so they come, and it's sort of like Holden. They come, they say, let go of me, Mom, and they go into the general store, and they have their own spot, and they, you know, take over. But it is a central activity to feed people, a very central activity, and it automatically allows for a level of conversation and exchange that I had absolutely no idea would be the case. And it has been, for women or men in your situation, a place where they landed for a while. It also is a way into the community for people out of their isolated lives. If they come into the Heartland, all of a sudden they know hundreds of people within a very short time, and they can pick and choose how much more contact they want to have with people beyond work or, but you know, if we house an event that informs them of the local green initiative, whatever that currently is in the city or some local political outlet for them, they're off and running, and I've seen it dozens of times. I feel that is part of our vocation, is bringing people out and letting them know, yeah, not only can you serve a mean table or put a mean batch of cornbread together, but you can serve your community, and your community needs you to. And that is the universal. And that's eventually what I want to move to in this discussion, is the social action aspect of right livelihood. Yes, sir.
How do you deal with, I have a friend who has been looking at the whole issue of these third places, you know, a good place where people come, lives apart purely from family or work, and where people get together. And I see Heartland in that role, having been to Heartland many times. And
written for our journal.
Loving the place. But he always says, you know, the tough deal is that restaurants, they're always figuring, like, how to get people in and out, you know, not to get, because that's where the money is. It's turnover and moving the customers through. And the good place wants people to stay around, hang out, even after they finish eating. And
luckily, we have a lot of room.
Yeah, so how do you solve that?
We don't. We don't have any real conflict with that. We have a lot of room. And if on a busy time, Sunday brunch, a big Saturday night, if it was busy, we really do have a lot of room. And we have a bar next door. So if it got crowded, and somebody was sitting there for hour after hour at one table on the outdoor cafe, I'd go up to them and I'd be very, very diplomatic. And I'd charm them into moving somewhere else so that I could seat someone at their table and they could still carry on their conversation in any one of the other places they can continue to do that. And in the course of doing that, you go, come here, come on into the bar. Here, there's room for all six of you. Don't mind him, he's from University of Chicago. And you know, and in so doing, you hook them up, you know, by making fun of them or something, you know, just saying, you'll have nothing to say to her because she's in recycling and you work for waste management. It just will never happen. You know, and 2 hours later, they're sitting there over Guinness. You know, whatever. Yes, sir.
Just many people have great passion over their work for a number of reasons. Some because of the kind of work they do.
Yes.
Others because of what it does to them. and still others because of what it does to their family. I think of immigrants particularly. You know, they come and many times the work may not be, certainly not the they want to spend their life doing.
Right.
But they really have passion for it because of what it's doing for them. It's like giving them entree into the American way and allowing them to bring their families over. It's doing all kinds of wonderful things. And but they still want to spend their life doing it. And I think, isn't it the fact that the Americans normally change careers two or three times, isn't it? Isn't that the average?
Seven times?
No. More.
Yeah, it has
the
changed.
The world progresses and even more.
Mm-hmm.
And almost everything, all work that's honest, serves the community somehow or another.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag there.
That's a lot said there. What was your work?
Do I have to tell you?
No, it's not a...
I've been in education.
You're in education?
Yeah. I was a college president for quite a few years.
Ah.
And I loved it.
Good for you.
It was an area of great passion for me.
Yes.
But some of us are lucky enough that our work spreads over into the rest of our lives. And others, you know, the work is just, it's a way to allow them to have the rest of their life spending stuff, doing something worthwhile for the community.
Is that okay for them?
Yeah. Well,
I don't you know, that's the thing. I don't know if that's okay.
I don't know if that's okay for them or not.
You know, is that just our rationalization or is that okay? For someone to
I don't think we can answer that for them.
Yeah.
I think they'll have to answer that for themselves.
That's
I
right.
I went to work for Boeing for many years and never liked it. I'm concerned about it.
And you think that's tragic.
I think it's tragic, but I don't think they think it's tragic.
And on the other hand, even if you think it's tragic, I would bet like crazy you never ever felt like saying, well, then get out of that job if you don't. Because of course you understood that's their economic prerogative. They have to do this, right? They have to put a roof over their head.
Right. Do I have to tell someone else? They should
right.
See, a lot of people that retired from Boeing, they're very happy. You know, and
now.
Retired.
Now.
They're very happy.
Yes,
John. This brings up another issue, which is sort of dear to me, which is I don't think everybody is going to have, I mean, this is wonderful, and I think I'm a very lucky person,
yes.
And I kind of have these things. And
exactly.
I do, but I don't think that's necessarily going to be possible for everybody, and people will have to do jobs that they don't aren't a passion for them, and that's going to continue for some time. What seemed to be, though, for many years in American society, up at least until the 30s, the aim was that as we productivity increased and we could do more in a certain amount of time, that instead of simply using that productivity to consume more and more and produce more and more,
really?
That people would work shorter hours.
Thank you.
And
the opposite has happened.
We had in the U.S. Congress of the United States in 1933, the U.S. Senate passed a bill that would have made 30 hours the official work week in the United States.
What year was that?
That's 67 years ago, 1933.
Yeah.
It only failed the House of Representatives by 4 votes.
Dang.
And here we are. We don't have that, even though our productivity is 3 times as high.
That's right. And connecting it with the consumer mentality is correct to do.
So I'm saying...
Which maybe, I think is connected to a lack of spiritual fulfillment in life in general. When you are drawn to the consumer mentality and so you go, okay, I got the color TV. Oh, I got to get a color TV and VCR. Oh, you know, you are never satisfied and you are surrounded by goods and you are not satisfied. It's the political and social reality that we are working more, making less. We are in the industrialized nations of the world. We have the shortest vacation time by a long shot. You know, all of the, and we have no social medicine, so that in places like mine, for example, there were a few years where we didn't have insurance at all because the insurance industry would not give insurance to restaurants because of AIDS. Okay? So, I mean, we had to go uphill and dale to get insured, and we cannot afford to insure all of our workers. We just make it available to them. And it's a perk for being a manager or another person who works ridiculous amounts of hours and for very low pay. So, you know, yes. So what of that? And why can we do so much and not that, which would seem so central to workers' happiness? Time off, reasonable vacation, health care, parental leave.
Huh? I thought it was illegal to provide benefits for certain employees unless you're providing for all employees.
No, it's not. It's to do with part-time. It has to do with percent of part-time and amount of time put in. But just don't go giving my name to the feds or anything. I already went through a lot with the IRS.
When you phrased the question that way about this and they, I always get confused because I look at that and I say that's an individual thing. It's not a they group. And so when I hear they and they must like that or, you know, those groups, it's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Because when we relate it to ourselves, that's where I hear whether or not you're doing that. And if you're not, why not? Because I would think, and I would guess this, so I'll throw out a question, because there's nobody in this room who would say that's a bad way of living. But I would say that's one assumption. And the other assumption is at least half of the people in this room would say, I don't got that. Or I didn't have it during my working day. And now, so those are assumptions, but that's more personal, because when you talk about they in 1933, and not being critical of that, we still had lynching in this country, though.
Right.
So it's like, it's okay to, you know, that blanket we throw out, I often look to, well, how does the fabric fit on you? Because maybe you could work 30 hours a week. I could. I think everybody in this room could make a livelihood. But do you want to? And what stops you from doing it?
Or they think they want to.
Well,
John was really...
In many cases, people actually can't. I mean, because if they, to get the job at all, they need to agree to work.
So you could.
I can work whatever hours I need. Okay. I feel like I'm a very lucky person who has a lot of advantages because of what I do in my class situation and stuff. I don't think that same good fortune necessarily is there for millions upon millions of people who either work 40 hours doing this thing or don't feed their families at all.
I'm supposed to end on time. And here are 11, I think, copies of a chapter called Work. If you want one, or if you have someone with you who you could share it with and thereby only take one, I'm going to leave them right here. And we'll refer to that a little bit. What I see happening with these sessions is to go deeper into a couple of areas. One is work, more of this concept of who can and can't and who does and does not have the privilege of, you know, designing a nice life of work for them right now, which to me is really inseparable from what kinds of social change and hence social action has to be part of our, you know, spiritual consciousness around work that will assist others. Because part of, again, a basic piece of right livelihood, a premise of right livelihood, is our interconnectedness, our interdependence. You cannot not affect the whole by your private, presumably private actions around work in the public place. You cannot. Everything, and that's a very highly spiritually based thing to say, but it's also, I think, one of those laws of physics. I just think it's true that we are interconnected. It's like somebody, one of the Japanese Zen monks used to do a comic strip and put zucchini faces on zucchinis. Then they were all connected to one root. And if one zucchini got big and healthy and strong, some of the others started withering. And it's a metaphor for, you know, part of our culture getting so full of itself and greedy and overabundant, it's inevitable that we're going to have these really, really sickly, poverty struck and wanting. And I see it in Chicago maybe more than some who don't live in a city see it. The gap is way too big for this to be called the U.S. and, you know, with our Bill of Rights. It's really, really scary. And so ultimately, I'd like to get into maybe the social action as spiritual practice. We didn't even talk about spiritual practice yet, so there's a lot to talk about. Come back again. Thank you for being here.